Hi, I'm your host, Alex Stonehouse, and on today's episode of Decisions That Matter, we are joined by Tim Hay to discuss preparedness and procurement. The coronavirus pandemic has forced procurement and preparedness into the spotlight and has taught us a lot about what we could have done differently and what we can do in the future to plan ahead and ensure that we are prepared for future events. And on top of the pandemic, right now the western states are battling raging wildfires in the U.S., while the southeast is currently in peak hurricane season. Tim walks us through some strategies on how to best prepare for a variety of scenarios. And as always, this podcast is brought to you by Procurated, where you can search for and ask questions about high-quality suppliers that can help you meet your preparedness needs and your procurement needs in any other area as well. This is a good one. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Decisions That Matter podcast, where we meet with leaders from across the procurement community to discuss innovative and strategic ideas. Because when it comes to procurement, every decision matters. Welcome to Decisions That Matter. I am happy to be joined today with my co-host, Bernadette Lonnie from Procurated, and Tim Hay, our special guest today, who has a wonderful career with over two decades of experience with both NASPO Value Point and the state of Oregon, and most recently did a stint in Washington, D.C. with FEMA. Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into the procurement space?
Well, I think like most people, by accident, you know, is that how we all get into procurement? I actually got into the procurement role in the private sector back in the early 90s at a snowboard manufacturing company here in Salem called Morrow Snowboards. And I worked there for a number of years in supply chain management, international procurement. And back in, you know, 99, the company was sold and they moved a lot of operations out of state, and I chose not to move. So I ended up landing a job with the state of Oregon with the DAS Central Purchasing Office. Later, it became State Procurement Office. And I put in 14 years at the state of Oregon as a state procurement analyst, and then eventually became the lead state procurement analyst and oversaw a team of professionals that primarily worked on services contracts, but I also dabbled a little bit in IT contracting and goods contracting as well while I was with the state. And then in 2013, I departed the state of Oregon and took on the role as a cooperative development coordinator with, then it was WISC and NASPO. It eventually became NASPO Value Point, and I was there for 7 years. By the time I departed NASPO Value Point, I was the cooperative development director, where I oversaw all the cooperative activities of the organization. We had 60 or so different portfolios, and I oversaw all of those to ensure they had a positive ROI, making sure things were, you know, happening on a timely basis, and had a couple of people working for me as we worked with the sourcing teams out there across the United States. Back in earlier this year, in April and May, I did have a short stint through a private contractor who contracted with the federal government to go back and work with FEMA as a senior supply chain consultant. And we tracked a lot of the material that was leaving the Strategic National Supply going out to the states. The states were requesting items, things like hydroxychloroquine, ventilators, mobile hospitals, equipment like that that's all stockpiled across the U.S. We were tracking all the requests that came in and basically consolidating all of the data that was out there and putting it into an Excel spreadsheet, just keeping track of the inventory so we knew what was going on. And that lasted for about 5 weeks. That was a very interesting and educational experience. Never flew on an airplane before that held 190 people, and I was one of two paying passengers. That was a really eerie flight.
That is wild. I still can barely picture that.
Yeah, it was amazing. Funny story is I was upgraded to first class, so I had the entire first class section to myself, and the pilot came out midway through the flight, and we were just chit-chatting. He goes, "You ought to sit in every seat in first class. How often can you say you've done that?" I said, "You're exactly right." So I am one of maybe a few people that can say I actually sat in every seat in first class on an airplane. But it was, and then when we got there, you know, the airports were empty. And it was just, a very interesting feeling, kind of an eerie feeling. I had one opportunity to go walk on Capitol Mall on a Friday afternoon, and you'd think it'd be crowded with people. It was, you know, around spring break, all that. Nobody on Capitol Mall. So I got these great, you know, pictures of the monuments and Capitol building and all that.
Yeah, the lack of tourists here in Washington, D.C. has definitely been noticeable for us who live here every day as well. So I'm glad you got to take advantage of that for sure. During this sort of the last few months with the coronavirus pandemic and that initial rush to get all of the ventilators and the PPE and all that, there's definitely been a little more of a light on procurement, I would say, than was on it beforehand. Obviously, a lot of talk about how people could have been more prepared or what they would do differently in the future. And we wanted to talk a little bit about preparedness today, which goes definitely beyond, obviously, pandemic stemming to anything from natural disasters or things that might be out of your control in terms of whether or not you can stop the events, but something that you still want to be prepared for. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you did earlier in your career in Oregon working on that preparedness strategy and what role procurement played in that?
So it all happened in, I think it was November of 2007. Prior to then, we really, you know, in the procurement office, we really never thought we had a role in the disaster response. And in 2007, what was known as the coastal gale force winds, hurricane force winds hit the Oregon coast and parts of the Willamette Valley. And not only did it bring massive winds that brought down trees and power lines everywhere, it also contributed to a lot of flooding. A lot of the snowpack that was up in the mountains was immediately melted and was just rushing down the river. So cities like Vernonia were just inundated with water. And the Emergency Command Center picked up the phone and called the, you know, state procurement office and said, hey, we need help. And it was a Wednesday or Thursday night, and I was at home trying to track down bottled water at 9 o'clock at night, you know, that was, you know, we were thrown into the realms of disaster response and assisting those first responders and those people supporting the people that are affected. And so I think that was a Thursday, the next, and then so Friday we came into the office and it was just basically all hands on deck. And of course, in that mind, you're just getting inundated with requests from the Emergency Command Center. We need this. We need tarps. We need porta potties, generators, you name it. We need it, you know, to support the people out there, either on the front lines, helping the people or those who are affected. And of course, we were competing with the state of Washington as well, because they are also having the same issue. So we ran into issues with supply chain. We also ran into issues with logistics because roads were closed. I-5, the main artery between Oregon and Washington is Interstate 5, and it was underwater in the Longview area. So you couldn't get goods out of the Seattle area down into Oregon. So we had to face those issues as well. And this was just happening a mile a minute as far as trying to find everything we need. So we had to really come together and start planning and saying, okay, who's going to work on what area? Who's going to handle logistics? Who's going to track the expenses? Because that's one thing people don't think about is when you're responding to a natural disaster, you don't think, well, FEMA's going to cover it. But they will to a certain extent, and you have to have the documentation to a T. You think doing your personal taxes is a nightmare. The FEMA documentation has got to be spot on. And so we actually had a person take charge in creating the forms that we filled out that matched the FEMA templates. So we tracked, we created an event log that would track the activity from pre-deployment to deployment or mobilization, and then most importantly, also demobilization. So that was one thing we really picked up on is getting the equipment back off the lines or maybe moving elsewhere. Say, you know, we were buying massive water filtration systems, portable water filtration systems for this coastal gale event. And it costs a lot of money to rent those things. And if it's no longer needed here, but if you know, if you have that available and say it's needed, move it from Vernonia down to Klaxonine or somewhere, then you would have that information and know what you have available. We also, you know, we never had a person over at the emergency command center before. So we ended up staging a person over there to coordinate getting the information back to the state procurement office. So we had a central person there. We had a central person at the state procurement office. And we were doing the coordination back and forth. And then as the information came in, then we would assign people to do various things. And, you know, we were getting things like portable fencing and porta potties and tarps and all the equipment you can think of, hand tools and food, you know, food and water as well, because a lot of people were staged in emergency evacuation centers. So we had to get those set up as well, cots for people to sleep on and, in, you know, blankets and pillows. And then also you think about other things like a lot of these areas are out in the country, so they have livestock. So we had to figure out, where can we put livestock at? You know, where can we set up a command center or an emergency evacuation center that can support that? So there's a lot of things that procurement really just got thrown into. And we were working, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week there for a while. Another thing that kind of came out of this too is when that event happened, we realized that we can't keep up this pace on our own. We're going to eventually have to get some help. And so who can we call on to come in and assist the state procurement office? Well, obviously we want to tap into other procurement resources from other state agencies who may not be affected by this. So we quickly developed some interagency agreements to say, we want to, you know, can we borrow some people from you, you know, employment? You know, right now it's kind of flip-flop when I talk about the employment department. They're scrambling for all the help they can get with all the unemployed people out there trying to, you know, make all the requests out there for unemployment come through. Well, it's kind of the same, you know, same theory, is like you utilize your resources best you can. And if somebody's got an excess, tap into those, that excess resource to where you can fulfill the need and, you know, move things around. It's all about, you know, being prepared and planning. And then we also had another person talking about tracking credit cards. We have, you know, everybody has, you know, spots cards or the small procurement transaction system, but there's only a handful of credit cards out there that had a really high dollar limit. So we had a spreadsheet developed that actually tracked the beginning balance or beginning credit value of that credit card. And we just tracked all the expenses that went against that card. So we knew, okay, well, this person still has $75,000 left to spend and this person has $30,000. So we kind of strategically placed our purchases accordingly to who had available credit on what card, and also who we could get a hold of too. There was only like five or six folks who had cards with that high dollar limit, and then everybody else was, you know, at that $5,000 or $10,000 limit.
That's smart.
Yeah, but after all this came about, you know, we had time to kind of take a breather and debrief. We thought, well, we did a good job, but we really need to get formally organized as far as developing a plan. So we invited several agencies who were involved with us to meet at the state procurement office, and we developed a disaster preparedness toolkit and or response toolkit. I heard a quote just the other day about, 90% of responding to a disaster is being prepared to respond to the disaster. And then the other 10% just falls in line. And that was the case here. We really weren't prepared, but we became more prepared afterwards. So this team worked together for a number of months, and we developed standardized documents that we would use across all state agencies. These documents would be the event logs, the tracking logs, credit card forms, the FEMA request logs. We also developed the interagency agreement that all the agencies agreed upon that we could use to transfer personnel from one agency to another if needed. We also developed a mobile office, and that mobile office contained a jump drive of all the documents that we, you know, created, as well as blank purchase orders, various selection of office supplies. We eventually were talking about getting radios in there. We never quite got that far because we knew if a big disaster hits, you know, they're expecting the Cascadia subduction zone out here in Oregon. That's going to be a 9 to a 9.5 event that's pretty much going to decimate the Willamette Valley in the Portland area. You know, the cell service is going to be down. What's going to be working is going to be really restricted to first responders out there. and other government personnel. So we knew that the state procurement office would probably fall short on the pecking order. So we thought we got to develop some sort of a mobile radio communication system as well. And we actually put together three mobile offices that people could take out and deploy. If we needed to deploy somebody to the eastern side of the state, we may do that. And we would just take them with the mobile office and they would go out and use it. We did some tabletop tests with it. We never did an actual virtual test with it while I was there, but they were always replenished about every 6 months. We refreshed them to make sure that the documents were up to date. We also put some snacks in there as well, because we know when you're out working, you want to make sure people are fed and are hydrated, you know, have water and all that, because you may be on your own for a while.
What do you mean by tabletop tests? What did those tests entail?
Well, those tests are basically everybody's just working in a room, a big conference room, and we come up with a scenario, and then everybody would have their individual roles, and they would use the resources that they have with them, with their mobile office, or if they're at the ECC or at the state procurement office, and they would implement those roles at that tabletop to see how it would work. We never did a real life action test at that level. However, I have had some experience in real life disaster events through another organization that I'm involved with Salem. I'm part of the community emergency response team. So when the big one hits, we all know we're going to be on our own for at least 2 weeks or more. So I'm actually been trained as a first responder. But one of the things we do every 3 years is go out and assist the airport with their disaster response. So we simulate a terrorist activity, and we have, you know, all the emergency medical personnel there, the fire department, EMTs, and I go out there and help, and I document all the events.
I really like the idea of these tests, especially doing them before, you know, any disaster strikes, to hopefully reveal any holes or, you know, anywhere that you still need to improve. Did any of those tests reveal like any gaps for you guys, or like any examples of something that you discovered something and then you were able to do something more to prepare should something like that happen?
Yeah, as with all tests, you really don't realize what gaps you may have until you're living it and doing that. And so we did identify a few things, like some of the documentation could have been beefed up to add a few more items that we wanted to track. So a lot of it was around documentation beefed up, or communication protocols. You know, one event that happened a few years later is we had some flooding here in Salem and in the Willamette Valley. And Mill Creek runs right through town, and it was starting to flood parts of the capital city. And so they deploy the ECC. The first night, I actually worked overnight at the Emergency Command Center. Well, the second night, we all decided that we could just work from home because with, you know, remote technology. However, I live in an area that's got spotty cell phone service. And somebody tried to contact me, and they were not able to get through. And so that was a real life event that, no, I didn't even forgot. I live in an area with bad cell phone service, and they only have my cell phone, and they didn't have my home phone, so they couldn't call me on the landline. So it's things like that you need to realize. You need to have a complete communication list with all available phone numbers on how to contact people, home addresses if possible. Maybe, you know, my manager at the time lives just around the corner from me. Maybe they could have contacted her and she could have ran over to my house and let me know what was going on. So it's protocols like that that you don't realize it until it happens. And then you think after the fact, well, we should, you know, establish this. And who's the backup for the backup? Because you never know what's going to happen in real life.
Yeah, I mean, this just sounded like such an awesome project, and it sounded like so much work went into it to really like check all those boxes and cover all those bases. Going back to when you identified the need for something like this to happen, was it hard to get buy-in from the government and from the people to like empower you guys to put all the man hours and the time into doing this? Or did they like automatically recognize the value that something like this had?
We had the buy-in from all of the agency directors, and the governor's office was informed as well. But we were working with the top people at the Emergency Command Center, We had top managers from DAS, the overarching agency, among all the other, you know, agencies. High-ranking officials were supportive at Department of Forestry, ODOT, Parks, State Police. They may not have been the ones at the table. We had more of the working-level people at the table to develop all the protocols and documentations and things like that. But they were very supportive of the concept and putting it all together. We even had Department of Justice involved as well, because, you know, yeah, you have to take that in consideration as you're developing these processes and these procedures, and also, you know, dealing with suppliers. One of the things we wanted to do too is make sure we had a robust supplier chain. Who could we contact in the middle of the night if we need something? So we were able to establish emergency contact numbers for the top like MRO type suppliers and vehicle rental suppliers and things like that. Just, you never know what's going to happen at 2 a.m. and who you might need to call.
Were most of the suppliers that you all worked with like national suppliers who might have a hub nearby, or were they more skewed towards local Oregon-based businesses?
It was kind of a mix, because see, we always believe in supporting our local suppliers, and sometimes they can be more responsive. You know, we got a local hardware store here in town, and you could probably call them up at 2 a.m. and meet you down there to get out ladders or shovels or whatever, versus trying to deal with the national chain. But it's nice to have that national backup as well, because if there's a major event occurs here in Oregon, all the local suppliers may be wiped out. You know, their buildings could burn down or collapse, or maybe the people who are involved with that store aren't able to get to the store because they're dealing with their own personal needs with their families and their property. So it's good to have a mix of a national and local suppliers you can call on. And when I say national, you might want to do more of a regional, because obviously I would rather pull something out of Montana that's a day away versus trying to pull something out of Virginia that could be 5 or 6 days away. So you want to kind of look at that as you're developing your supplier base.
So obviously, like, so much to think about with, you know, a disaster response kit like this. If you, you know, were talking to someone who maybe had only like 3 months to build something, what would you identify as maybe the first like three things that you must have in that disaster response kit?
Oh man, that's a great question. So if they had 3 months to get something built, obviously get the agreement, get the key people that you're going to want to work with together, and get everybody to agree on a plan. And as you develop that plan, then you start identifying the documentation that you need to create, because documentation is key to keeping track of everything, whether or not you're trying to get FEMA money back. You want to make sure you document it all, because in the end, you're going to have to account for all that money that was spent. And then try to do a test. What you've pulled together, you know, with the people that you brought to the table, created the documentation, just do some sort of a tabletop test just to identify any gaps you may have. You know, a great place to start if you don't know where to begin is look to states that may have put something together. Oregon has done a great job. In fact, Oregon took the Bronze Award with the NASPO Cronin Award in 2011 or 2010 for this disaster preparedness kit, this program they put together. So they'd be a great place to ask as a resource. There's other states out there that have also put together a disaster response. Or just go out and use some of the national organizations, like NIGP has their Insight. That'd be a great place for somebody to go to and just ask the question, has anybody ever done this? And I bet you'll get a ton of response, because everybody is really passionate about wanting to make sure everybody's prepared. That's one thing I've noticed in this world is everybody, you know, like I said earlier, you got to be prepared and be ready to respond. And everybody wants to help to make sure everybody has the tools they need to put those tools in place.
Did anything stand out to you during your time in DC working on the COVID response that was maybe drastically different or a little bit different or maybe exactly the same to how the state or smaller governments approach an issue versus how the federal government had to look at something like that?
In my time at DC, I really states are pretty well set up to respond to disasters, because they have more of a centralized focus when it comes to their e-procurement systems. That's one thing that I noticed that the federal government was lacking, is there was a lot of individual systems that could maybe possibly be combined down the road to where there could be some crosswalk between the systems, where the states already have that system in place and it seems to be, it runs pretty efficiently.
I like to ask all of our guests on the podcast the same question. Is there anyone in your career that you were particularly impacted by in a positive way that helped kind of guide you along, or that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Boy, I'm going to take three people that have really impacted my career. Two of them were actually at the state procurement office. One was Diane Lancaster. She was the chief procurement officer, and we were each other's rocks in that office, as she said. We backed each other up. We both had the same way of thinking about things, and she really was supportive of me and my career and taking a chance. And because that's the thing about, you know, getting ahead in life is you got to take a chance to try to improve things. And Diane was really supportive of that. And then Melissa Canfield, she was my direct manager, and she was that manager that you could just go in and you could close the door. And you could just, if you needed to vent, she would let you vent. And then she let you walk out. And she was just very supportive that way. And she really wanted to see you grow as well. And then the other person that I really admire is Doug Richens. He used to be the chief procurement officer for the state in Utah. And then he was the CEO for Value Point. He is one of those gentleman that's just got such a even keel, kind of soft-spoken, kind personality. He truly has a way of finding the good qualities of everybody and bringing them out of that person so they can excel. Diane and Melissa, don't hate me for this, but I will say Doug is probably one of the best managers in my life, if not the best manager I've ever worked for. But Melissa and Diane are a close second.
Thank you so much for joining us on this call. Is there anything else you want to say before we hop off?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity to talk with you folks. And if anybody wants to follow up with me with individual questions, feel free to do so. I'm easily found on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to Decisions That Matter. This podcast is brought to you by Procurated, the leading supplier evaluation tool for procurement professionals across the U.S. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you prefer to listen. See you again next time.